to be here with Peace Fresno and to share a podium with so many fine speakers. I was really fascinated by the Abby Hoffman appearance of Thomas Ian Nicholson, and I come from
the good people of Chicago.
Well, do I remember both Mayor Daley experiences. And I'm also very, very grateful to have heard Rick Race. I will really appreciate a chance to talk further with him, and I kind of envy all of you for having him in your state, and I hope that that dialogue will certainly continue. I can testify that Dan and Camille and others have been working to pull us together for this event for quite some time. So it's a big privilege to be here with people who care so deeply that on a beautiful afternoon when it didn't rain for the weekend of the Peace Fresno event, you're gathered here together. So I just want to check, can people in the back hear me in the back of the seated area? And I hope I'm not blasting you out in front. Okay. Well, thank you, and I'll just confess that the high school study teacher in me is going, oh, everybody's not quiet. But that's not going to happen, so God bless everybody. Anyway, that's the high school study teacher in me. But that really does introduce what I want to speak about next. You know, you cannot take that high school study teacher out of you if you've taught for many, many years. If any of you here are teachers, you'll back me up on that. So that got me in a whole big pot of trouble at one point, and I'd like to tell you this story because I think it's given me an insight, kind of a rudder, if you will. Dan mentioned that you've got an ex-con in front of you, and I've been arrested on a number of occasions, I think always with good reason. But I had gone down to the School of the Americas, the Fort Benning School of the Americas, shortly after coming back from Iraq, and I'd lived in Iraq during all of the bombing of the Shock and Awe aerial bombardment and the United States occupation. Are we getting a feedback here? Yeah. And I really, when I came back to the United States, my sense was show me the line and I'll cross it, because I wanted to take an action confronting US militarism, which would kind of raise the risk level a little bit. And I knew that I would most likely be sent to federal prison. But honestly, on the day when I crossed the line at Fort Benning, there were 16,000 people there. I think there were 28 other people that took the action with me. And it wasn't my first season out. I probably wasn't thinking about it with any more anxiety than I would have thought about going through the security check at O'Hara Airport. Honestly, I thought, well, I know how to do this. We were in a room about exactly the size of the room we're in right now. And we were immediately handcuffed when we were arrested. But then we were poised at the door of this big kind of gym area and told to go to various stations. So I was all set to do what I'm told. I kind of, you know, follow orders in those situations to some extent. So I was told to go to Station J. And I walked over to Station J and I noticed that there were five people processing the people arrested, and they were dressed in full camouflage garb, and they had one had a big clipboard. And the orders were being shouted, which was a bit unusual to me. Someone was actually shouting at me immediately after they took off my handcuffs, raise your arms, spread your legs, look straight ahead of you, don't say anything. And out came the high school study teacher in me. I turned to the young woman shouting at me and I said, excuse me, but could you please help me understand why you're screaming at me? Don't say anything. Keep your eyes glued on the person in front of you. Raise your arms higher. Spread your legs further. And I was looking around the room, and the other people being searched in the same fashion were mostly nuns and priests and women and men older than me. And then somebody was sticking her hand inside my clothing, and somebody else was squeezing my behind. And I thought, wait a minute. This is not the way it's supposed to be done. So the high school study teacher comes back again. And very quietly, I said, I'm sorry, but I can't cooperate with this any longer, as I lowered my arms. Bam! I was down on the floor in seconds. I had a black eye from the impact. My wrists were tied. My ankles were tied. My wrists and ankles were tied together, and someone about the size of Phil over there was kneeling on me and referring to me as this bleep. I won't say it, but it begins with F. And I thought, oh my. This is quite serious. And I couldn't breathe. And so I said to anybody who was listening, I'm sorry, but you're hurting me and I can't breathe. Nothing. No let up. And so I thought, well, I better try again. And I said, excuse me, but this really hurts and I can't breathe. It's not having any effect at all. And at that point, I honestly started to worry, I'm going to pass out. And so I said, look, I've had 4 lung collapses in the past and I can't breathe. That did it. The person kneeling on me got up, and I actually had congenital disease tissue covering 3/4 of one lung and half of the other, so I told the truth. But anyway, I was okay. But I want to continue to tell this story to you because they carried me hogtied to the next station where they take your picture, right? And in order to take my picture when they had me propped up, but I'm still hogtied, and they had taken the clip out of my hair, so the hair was in front of my face. I looked like the shaggy dog, right? One of the soldiers who had carried me under my right armpit said, I know those cuffs are real tight, ma'am, but we're gonna get them off of you as soon as we can. And I just have to ask you, is it okay if I move the hair out from in front of your face? And I said, yes, that would be fine. And so he moved the hair out from in front of my face. They took my picture, and then he ever so gently squeezed my shoulder. And again he said, like I said, ma'am, we're gonna get those cuffs off of you as soon as we can. I know they're real tight. Well, I needed that. And isn't that how it so often goes? Some measure of humanity reasserts itself just when you think humanity's gone out the window. But it has been very, very important for me to remember that story, to remember the kindly soldier, to remember that the other soldiers were doing what they were told. They were doing what they were training to do. Now in May, when I go back to Chicago, I'll do a little bit more speaking, but then in May, I'm going to go back to jail for 10 days. And I'll be jailed because I crossed the line again. And this time it was at a place called Fort McCoy in Wisconsin. And at Fort McCoy, the soldiers, before they deploy to Afghanistan or to Iraq, they go into a model village inside of Fort McCoy that's made to look like an Afghan village or an Iraqi village. And they practice kicking in the doors and ripping apart mattresses and turning over the furniture and emptying the cabinets. And they practice raiding the household and searching for weapons. But immediately, as soon as they go in, and often with dogs that terrify the householders, they hogtie the men in the household and they put them in pickup trucks and take them away to be interrogated, sometimes for days, sometimes months. And are we to think that this is the way to win people over, to believe in us as people who bring about security? And this is why I'm so grateful to Rick Grace, who has helped us understand what it was like for him to be a soldier in that context. Now, you know that unmanned aerial vehicles are being used again and again and again daily to give us surveillance, to give us intelligence, to give us information about what's happening in Afghanistan. But those unmanned aerial vehicles, those drones, will never be able to tell us what it's like for someone to try to raise a child in a country that the UN tells us is the worst country in the world into which a child can be born. Afghanistan, where 850 children die every single day. Yes, we should be asking, who are the Taliban? Not so that we can kill them, but so that we can know. Why would someone pick up a gun and join a Taliban group? Well, there are plenty of insights. I was in Pakistan in May of this past year, and a man took 2 long bus rides and walked a long distance to come to talk with us. And we were wondering, what's it like to survive one of these drone attacks? And so he began to tell us that he lived in a small village. There were only 500 people in the whole village. No road even leading up to the village. And one day, strangers, 3 of them, came on foot. Now in this village with the Pashtun Wali code, it's not a question. If strangers come to your door and knock, and you have water or you have food, you share it. I mean, you can't say, well, the 7-Eleven is that way and Motel 6 is that way. If you don't share with strangers who walked such a long way, they could actually die of dehydration. But yes, this has just been the custom back to the time of the first century. And so when the strangers went to the home of the village elders who have to set the example, enact the code, they were welcomed. They were fed. They were given something to drink. They were long gone at 4:30 in the morning when a United States drone fired two Hellfire missiles into exactly that home, killed 14 people, two of them village elders. And I asked our friend, well, what do you do if you don't have an ambulance or a road? How do you take the survivors somewhere for help? And he said, yes, just you see, we take the tabuta, this long scarf you are wearing, and we wrap it as tight we can around their wounds, and then they are bleeding very much, but we take them on our shoulders and we run until we get to the road. And then he explained that that morning at the roadside, they waved until they finally stopped a car, but the driver heard what had just happened, and you could still hear the drone airplane flying overhead. And so the driver sped away as fast as he could. Well, of course, the driver knew that he might be in the crosshairs if he gave help to people that were being associated with some kind of Taliban or Al-Qaeda supporters. The military call it warheads on the foreheads. They talk about high-value targets. And again and again and again, we hear stories of a mistake having been made. But at any rate, amongst the Afghan people, our friend told us, the word goes out on their cell phones far and wide, this bloody thing has happened again. And I asked our new friend, can you imagine that if some American people came and wanted to sit down with you and your friends in your village that's been hit so badly to talk about peace, would anyone from your community talk with us? And he looked at me, honestly bewildered. He said, Madame, who would be so crazy as to not to want the peace? But then he said, if you come, we will welcome you, but you must leave your weapons behind. Who would be so crazy as to not to want the peace? I've been thinking about a story that's a little bit hopeful, but we have to really hear it. On September 4th, the story starts very, very badly. The Taliban had hijacked two big oil tankers full of oil, and they weren't very good at driving these oil tankers along the right roads, I guess. Anyway, they got off the road, bogged into a quagmire, and the tankers began to sink in the mud. There was no way to push them or to pull them, so the Taliban gave up on it and just took off. Now, in any part of the world where people are desperately poor, what's going to happen next? Of course, people from far and wide somehow got the word, free petrol. So they came running, they congregated, they each got the kids and the biggest container they could find, and they ran up to these vehicles, and they started to siphon off the petrol, the free gasoline, benzene, oil. This was wonderful. And so more and more people came. Well, on a German surveillance machine, it looked as though, indeed, more and more people are gathering. They didn't seem to know about the tankers stuck in the quagmire. And so the German official had a big decision to make. Should he call for US air support to kill what might be assembled Taliban or Al-Qaeda sympathizers, and feeling he must support his troops, feeling he had a responsibility to preserve German lives, he called in the air attack. The air attack came with rockets and with mortars and with bullets, and there were dozens of civilians killed. In one report I read, 94 civilians killed. On September 6th, Germany's defense minister went on national TV and tried to play it down. He basically lied to the public. He said, we had it on impeccable authority that those were insurgents and that our troops were in danger. What he didn't know was somebody else had it on video. And when the video of what had actually happened came out with very clear footage that these were civilians trying to siphon off the petrol, that they were farmers or they were villagers, the German public was enraged. They were furious. There was an outcry, and it kept on going. The media kept covering it. Politicians kept speaking about it. But ordinary Germans kept saying, we don't want to live with this, until November 27th, Germany's defense minister had to resign. Well, actually, they transferred him to be in charge of the education department, so life has its contradictions. Then the two top generals representing Germany in NATO also had to resign. It would kind of be like their McChrystal and their Petraeus had to take off, find another job, and they put in new people. Now, this isn't a perfect story. It would have been best if German people had said, just pull on out of Afghanistan. But the reason I think I want to spend time with this story is it is an arrow. It points us toward where we might go. Do you know, when I was a child, and I think like many of you, as I grew up, I wondered to myself, how could German people ever, ever have tolerated the rise of Nazism? But what a sad juncture when I read this story and I think, wow, how could a society ever manage to put people out of office that lie to them? Because we take it in terms of this war again and again and again. I'll guarantee you Rick Ray speaking the truth to us was an exception today, and we need to thank him for his courage, but we have to demand that exception, because we're being lied to on a weekly basis with regard to the atrocities, whether it's a drone attack or an air attack, again and again. And I don't speak Pashtun, I don't speak Dari, I'm getting this out of the New York Times, but I'm developing a long list of these atrocities, and then General McChrystal will go on national Afghan TV with the words dubbed into Pashtun, into Dari. He says, we're sorry, we're so very sorry. Now we're not gonna let it happen again, but it's been going on again and again and again, and Americans don't feel the sorrow of a My Lai massacre. Americans don't feel the sorrow of war. And so in deference and deep respect for Effie, your George Balkas, I'd like to follow his lead in coming up here and singing. And I'd like to take a song that many of you heard, you sang it as kids. When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah. That's not how that song started. That song started as an Irish ballad. And it was an anti-war ballad sung about Irish soldiers who came back, some of them armless, legless, from a war in the Seychelles that they were conscripted into. And the words begin, where are your legs that used to run, haroo, haroo? Where are your legs that used to run, haroo, haroo? Before you went to carry a gun, I believe your dancing days are done. Oh, Johnny, I hardly knew you. Where are your eyes that look so mild? Haroo, haroo. Where are your eyes that look so mild? Johnny, I hardly knew you. It goes through asking, where are each of the body parts? But then ends up, you're an eyeless, earless, chickenless egg. You'll have to be put out with a bowl to beg. Your Peggy will never leave you. But it ends on a note of hope. They're rolling out the guns again. Haroo, haroo, they're rolling out the guns again. Haroo, haroo, they're rolling out the guns again. But they'll never take our daughters and our sons again. No, they'll never take our daughters and our sons again. Oh, Johnny, I'm swearing to ya. Swear to it. We can liberate ourselves. Those cuffs are so tight. Ma'am, those cuffs are so tight, sir, that bind us to war. Take those cuffs off. Stand up to these warmongers and war profiteers. Say we will not be a people that are turned into a warlike culture. We're through with war, we're people of peace, and we can claim it. Raise the level of risk that we're willing to take. If not us, who? If not now, when? Let's be sure that we make our voices heard. Raise your voices for creative nonviolence, and we'll catch courage from one another every step of the way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.